Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. The urge to set out and see the world seems hardwired into humans, but it takes a special person to answer the call and to return to tell us what they've seen. William Least Heatmoon is just such a person. His experience of America is singular, as millions who have read his books affirm. For Mr. Heatmoon, the inspiration and the rewards go a lot farther than just taking a trip. It's an experience that allows him to create and recreate himself.
It took some months, probably a couple of years, before whoever got rebuilt on that river could begin to show himself.
And he probably couldn't do it till he had written about it, could he?
Well, absolutely not. Every time I write a book, I take the trip physically, and then I go home. And for, in the case of Blue Highways, 4 years. In the case of Prairie Earth, 8 years. In the case of this of River Horse, another 4 years to write it. And that's another journey entirely. And that's the one. It's not more important than the other, but it certainly is equally important. And that's the one that turns Well, let me say it this way: that turns a trip into a journey.
William Least Heatmoon is a writer. His mix of adventure, reporting, philosophy, and humor have become a standard by which travel books are judged. He has now supplemented his best-selling classics, Blue Highways and Prairie Earth, with stories and insights drawn from having crossed America by boat, a journey memorably recorded in River Horse. With a Ph.D. in English and an undergraduate degree in journalism, Mr. Heatmoon lives near his beloved Missouri River. Always ready for an adventure, Bill Russell and I welcomed the opportunity to go exploring with this remarkable individual. William Least Heatmoon, I think you have helped me think differently about the times in which we've lived, or do live, and will live. I think a lot about we live in a time of great change, but you, with River Horse in particular, have helped me to use a metaphor that the Native Americans use, which is that of the serpent. Now, the snake, the serpent, gets a real bad time in a lot of cultures, but in the Indian cultures, it is the sign for river. And you talk about snakes lots of different times and places, and I'd forgotten about how they come out of their skins, that there's a transforming experience. Are those transforming experiences what you're about when you hit the road in all of your many different modes?
I think so. I'm not sure that I begin a trip with that consciously as a goal. On the other hand, it is something that seems as a result of the travel to happen naturally, and I think I'm happiest when it works that way. But to qualify that a bit, with this new book, River Horse, I did set out partly with the idea of wanting to see what America looked like from the rivers, to take a boat into places that one can't see unless you go by water and get the view from that level.
You mean literally?
Literally, yes, from water level. So I went with the idea that if this trip works well, if this voyage across the continent works well, then I will come out probably seeing America differently.
Well, and to work well is to be open to it being any of a lot of things. You didn't have in mind this is what it is to work well, did you?
No. In fact, working well sometimes can be a horrific experience, as Lake Erie proved to be for us for those 6 hours that we were getting beat on there. And on Blue Highways, my first book, many of those experiences were things that were difficult to undergo at the time, for emotional reasons. But when I got back and began writing about this, I found that was the very thing I needed to try to see something anew. I guess there's an old rule of thumb for journalists that when the going gets tough, you're probably going to suffer, but you're going to get much better copy than when the going is easy.
I remember when I was a kid saying something glib about, oh, I'd like to write, and the person I was talking to said, oh, what would you like to write about? Now, I was little, and it just stopped me cold. And the person said, well, maybe you need to go out and experience some things before you become a writer, because you don't have anything to say yet. Is that part of what you're headed toward, that you got to have something to talk about?
I'm a firm believer in that, Paula. We have a book coming out now by a 15-year-old singer from Wales, and I gather she's really quite a good singer, but I just wonder, what can a 15-year-old she's writing her autobiography, I forgot to say.
At 15?
This is the autobiography at 15 years. What in the world can she have to say that an adult would want to read? Maybe this is for the 15-year-olds, I don't know. But the book certainly is moving along. No, I think that to write one must have a certain amount of experience. One must be beat up a little bit before that you have a text to work from. That's the bad news. The good news about that is that writers, as artists, typically can work much farther into their dotage than others can. Painters perhaps being an exception, but certainly dancers, that can get very difficult.
If you keep up these kinds of trips, you're not going to work into your dotage. You're old enough to know better. How did you get into this mess?
Well, I fit in 1978 when I found my marriage collapsing, and I had sent out 300 letters the year before looking for a job teaching, and I was a fresh new PhD in English literature. Sent out 300 years the following year, 600 letters. Nobody wrote back to say, please come and let us interview you. I thought there was a message in here that I didn't receive, which was, try something new, son. So that's when I took off and tried to put my life together during those 3 months over the back roads of America, the journey I describe in Blue Highways.
This is William Lee's Heat Moon. He was led by geese on that journey. When we come back, we'll see what other leads he has followed. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, and I hope you'll be with us when we return. We're back with the Paula Gordon Show. We are delighted to have William Lee's Heat Moon with us. You say in River Horse that somebody wanted to go with you and that they were real eager to, you know, wouldn't that be fun to go across country on a boat? Which is already a pretty imposing idea. But you say kind of quietly and to yourself and to me, the reader, if they only knew what it take to get those few good moments in the course of a day, isn't there a great big lesson in that?
Well, I think that one needs to be, to have a book contract hanging over one's head to make a trip like this. That was the first thing.
There is a certain motivation there, isn't there?
If a writer accepts certain royalties, advances on royalties from a publisher, after a while he's got to come up with something, and I found myself in that situation.
Really? Is that part of what set you
off? It was. But it was something more than I didn't want to write a book on that would explore issues of clean water. I wanted it to be a book that ordinary readers could pick up. I did not want it to be a book for environmentalists. They already know the issues. I wanted to reach the people who are maybe not aware of these issues, but who, with proper information, then could weigh and decide whether it's important that we have clean water or not. I wanted to evaluate the Clean Water Act of the 1970 to see, has this made a change in our waters? So I was looking for a story that would hold these various water issues. And the one I kept coming back to that I thought people might read was some kind of adventure with water, and no greater adventure than trying to take a boat from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean, staying within the country the whole way.
Well, and twice over, because it's such an American story, starting in New York, starting virtually at the foot of the Statue of Liberty, and going westering, as you say. America didn't eastering. You tell me that in your book. The adventure is to go from the east to the west. So there are many levels of this adventure, aren't there?
That's true. I considered going the other way, from the Pacific to the Atlantic.
Because you're a contrarian?
No, well, I knew it was going to be hard going east to west, and I thought, well, maybe west to east is easier, primarily because you have our longest river there, the Missouri River, about 2,300 miles today. People think Mississippi is our longest river. That's not true. And by going west to east, that would allow us to go downstream for 2,300 miles.
There's
instead
some
of fighting
appeal
the current.
There.
Oh, yes. It looked very good. The problem is there's something on the other side of the Continental Divide called the Salmon River, also called the River of No Return. Not because if you take it, you don't come back, but because in the old days, if you went downstream on it, that is toward the ocean, westerly, you didn't come back up in the boat. Today we've got something called jet boats, which can ascend the Salmon River, but I was not about to use a jet boat. They're just environmentally really unsound and unhappy things. So that, as well as my wish, as you say, Paula, to follow our history in a western motion. I should say white history, because red history probably is an eastern motion. Movement over
southerly
the eons.
And easterly.
Southerly and easterly, yes, indeed. Yeah.
The impression, reading your book, and I think it's a tribute to the quality of your writing, is that this book sort of wrote itself.
Right.
I mean, all you had to do was make a few arrangements, get on the phone, get your boat, and paddle along, and you know, and just record the adventures as they occurred, inevitably. And yet, from the time that you finished this journey to the time you published this book was a while. Now, it could be that your publisher didn't care, but it could also be that there is something in addition required to having had the experience, that somehow or other those experiences have to ferment.
Percolate.
Or you have to work with them, or you have to, you know, there's a some sort of cosmic struggle between you and your experiences in order to get them down in a form that will capture people and will carry them along on that trip. Are you lazy, or did it really take time?
Well, certainly no. People certainly know that I'm a slow writer and I can procrastinate, but I think that procrastination primarily is what you're suggesting here. I'd like to think so anyway, and that is coming off of a journey, whether it was the Blue Highways journey or my second book, Prairie Earth, that was an 8-year journey, mm-hmm. Off and on, or the River Horse journey, 4 months. I think I have to, my heart and soul has to catch up with this. So I'd like to think, yes, there's percolation going on. But also, Bill, I must say that with River Horse, sometimes they say Blue Horse or River Highways. I answered all of them.
Bill's Adventures.
with River Horse, I had a literary problem that involved my co-pilot. This 5,200-mile journey by water, I was never alone. I had somebody with me the whole time because I felt I needed that kind of assistance. This was a difficult and dangerous trip in places. So I had a co-pilot with me, my co-pilots. There's seven of them, 6 men and 1 woman. When I got back, I thought, this is easy. That we've made the trip. They've helped me do it. I'm in debt to them. But when I sat down and started to write, I realized if I told what happened, honestly, in this book, the reader's going to love that. If I don't tell it, I'm in trouble. I knew I had to tell the truth. I'm a reporter. But if I tell the truth and give the names of the people who were involved in these incidences, given that oftentimes we are under duress and stress, at which times we don't acquit ourselves so well, I'm going to embarrass or perhaps even shame my co-pilots. So for a year, I couldn't get started because I couldn't find a way around that other than making a kind of sequential character out of my co-pilot. And eventually I did that.
I have to say, the pilotus device, there are many things that are riveting about River Horse, but none any more than pilotus, because you don't tell me for a long, long time that who this is, that you have created something other and different and in a way bigger than the other person on the boat. And for the first 150 pages, I keep thinking, who is this? Is this a man or a woman? Who is Pilotus? Is this a Greek character? You have the literary devices that you invent are fabulous. So that not only is it a great read, Bill's saying, why is she talking and not he? It's a great read, but it also
Why didn't you read the cover page? You know, it would have answered all your questions.
Well, but the cover page was even more alluring because you tell me that it's one woman and 6 men. But then there are no pronouns that say Pilotus, he or she.
Yes.
Well,
which had to be incredibly hard.
And what you seem to have done, and I assume it was intentional, is to essentially synthesize a real person out of those many, many people, which is no small task, I would think.
It was tricky at times. It got more so because I didn't begin with that as an idea. Once I decided to protect my friends, I needed to create this sequential character. With the understanding that would allow me to tell a greater truth than if I named them and had to protect them. So in other words, what I'm saying here is that whatever I quote Pilotus is saying or doing, the reader can be sure, I hope, that that's really what happened, because I am free to do that.
But just don't know the individual who happens to be coming forth with this.
The names of the 7 people, as Bill says, are on the second page of the book, although you can't believe how many reviewers fail to read the second page of the book.
It's one thing when you forget to read the acknowledgments at the end, but the second page?
The second page, yes, yeah. But the box that I got myself into, I began writing the book with the notion that because one of these co-pilots was a woman, I can't go changing gender. Pilotus can in New York City be he, and then by the time we hit Pittsburgh, is she, and by Kansas City, it's a he again, and so on. I figured the reader might accept this name of Pilotus, which I hoped was patently not anybody's name. It clearly comes from co-pilot. But I was talking with a friend of mine who's one of the leading feminist writers in America, Mary Kay Blakely, and telling her, writer to writer, about this problem, and I had solved it because Pilatus was now a he. And she stared at me in disbelief, and after a while she said, you take one woman along on this cross-country voyage, and then when you get home, you remove her gender from the book. I said, yes, I have to. I'm still for ERA, just I can't put it in that way. She said, oh, yes, you can. I said, well, please tell me. She said, do you remember Virginia Woolf? Do you remember Orlando, the character without a gender? I said, of course. It was so obvious. But I had to go back and change the first third of the book, and that was a real trick to get rid of pronouns, mm-hmm. the he's and the his's and the him's.
Well, maybe it should have been Piloto.
Well, I originally spelled it differently. I gave a masculine ending to it, and I changed the spelling so it was a neutral, a gender-neutral ending on the name Pilatus. But it was difficult at times trying to keep Pilatus as a person without gender. I'm not sure that it really succeeded because when I talked to people about the book, everybody says he, and then I finally say to them, but why are you saying he? You know, it's not a he entirely. Well, they say it felt like a he.
Well maybe they've learned something.
I think that they're considering women from the 19th century or something because women now do what men do, and if you take the obvious gender references out, you can't tell that this is a male or female.
Well, and some of the charm in listening to you tell that story, I think, is writing without pronouns. I mean, we tend to, I think in a lot of ways, overuse pronouns and neglect to have a referent to that pronoun, which makes understanding. But in a way, the whole flow of the language is altered by the absence of pronouns.
We're going to come back with William Lee Heatmoon in just a moment. That was Bill Russell.
We'll be a little less arcane about talking about the language. And
well, or maybe not.
We could go to adverbs.
No, Bill, no adverbs. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Please be with us when we return. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted that William Lee Heatmoon is our guest. When you were saying that you wanted to write a book that talked about water and clean water, it was really the first time, as you said that I thought, oh, because that isn't how the book feels. There is, what's the word, Bill? It's not didactic. It's not, it doesn't
tendentious,
preach.
Didactic.
It doesn't preach, but it does tell me all kinds of things, and it's part of why I was taken by this notion of snakes come out of their skin and they can leave the old skin behind, because I did get a sense that Aldous Leopold, you say in the book, was talking to himself and he was really lonely, but in the course of those intervening years, more people have become aware, and things like your book that nobody would know is a screed about dirty water. Is that part of your calling?
Well, I think so. I think my job as a reporter, as a writer, if you prefer, is to present the facts, to show, not tell, to use the old cliche. Mm-hmm. I think when writers show, provided that they're dealing with the truth to start with, and they're doing their very best to render it straightforwardly, there's no such thing as complete a lack of bias. We all have our biases, and I'm not afraid to show those. But within the context, and are the rest of the facts correct? That's really what I wanted to do, hoped to do, tried to do with River Horse.
It also wasn't tame. I was really surprised at what an adventure, no kidding, you had getting in the water in New York and getting out of the water in down the mouth of the Columbia River. I was surprised that there was that much thrill left in it.
Oh, it's 1995, the year that we made the voyage, was a year in flooding terms, that was second only to the great floods of 93, 2 years earlier. But there were places on the Missouri River, especially the lower Missouri River, where the water was higher than it had been in 93. It made the voyage in some ways easier because there was so much water we could take our little boat just about anywhere and still get upstream. The problem was at the end of the day when it was time to tie up or get off the river, that got tricky because those places were frequently that you got to shore, you went through the woods to get there, and you don't want to be in there with a boat.
Mm-hmm. We tend to think of water, I think, when we think of it at all, as a utility. You know, it's the water we drink, and that's pretty much it. And if we think of it beyond that, then it is a transport utility. That is to say, we use it to move things around about the country, big, bulky cargoes. And in a sense, that's what you were doing, was using water as a utility, as a means of transport. But what you also do, and I think much more substantially, is make it a living, vital system in itself, but in some ways even more importantly, the whole ecology of it, including the human influence, but also the other pieces around it, which makes it a much richer environment, and just, you know, to me opens up a world. You know, we're still searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. I argue we should be searching for terrestrial intelligence. but what you present is a different intelligence, a different life form than is, I think, is our common experience.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that response. And I like your notion of utility. Certainly, we do tend to think of rivers today in that way. And that's one of the reasons I think that we abuse them, because we see them only as ways of sending off our effluent or bringing our drinking water, usually from the same river. Just depends on who's upstream. Mm. As I say in River Horse that we all live downstream, depending on how you look at it. But I also like your phrase, Bill, about transport, because it was a means of transport in terms of moving a boat, moving us across the country. But also, I hope this is the case, and I hope it's evident in River Horse, that it transported us emotionally and spiritually, too. And in that way, I wanted the river to be something of a metaphor for a journey. I guess I'm going back to the question that you began with, Paula, about this. The means of transport in good travel writing, if that's what I do, really should go beyond just the fact that this is a wheel, this is a hull, these are the soles of shoes, whatever means a traveler's using.
I picked up Prairie Earth again, and I hadn't read the whole thing for a number of years, but was flipping through, and you can always tell when I like a book because I've touched it, I've marked it. I shouldn't tell, but you were talking toward the end of Prairie Earth about one of your buddies, and you always seem to find people to go with you, and you were at that point walking. But each of those modes of transport, whether you're in a car or on a boat or hoofing it, it always seems to be that same sense of going someplace that your spirit needs to go, that you're, and I don't mean to sound woozy about this, but it really almost didn't matter what your means of transport was. Do you have different feelings about these three quite different approaches to being someplace? Two of them moving and one of them sitting still for 8 years?
Well, the sitting still really is, as you suggest, there is, was moving by foot. It's moving in a small place, so it could seem almost sitting still, but that's such a big county out in Tallgrass Prairie.
Middle of Kansas.
In Kansas, yeah. I think... I think what I want to say about that is that when I'm moving, it's a way of trying to enter the land, the American landscape, simply because land is so incredibly important to me, and I think that's maybe part of an expression of my Osage background. While that's a fraction of my English-Irish blood, that Osage background is so important in the material that I write about and the way that I see it. On this long book tour that I'm on, two things happened. A couple of weeks ago, we were flying up just inside the coast of California, Los Angeles to Seattle, and it was pretty cloudy, but the sky broke, and I sit there and watch the window most of the time when I'm on a flight. I always get a window seat. And the clouds are broken. I looked down, and there was Yosemite Valley. I could see the falls, and it was... I never really understood the topography of Yosemite until I saw it from the air, and I just couldn't believe it. And I looked around quickly. Nobody else was looking out the window. They were either asleep or reading. When we got off the plane, the captain was there to say so long to us, and as I went by, I said, "You flew us by a great view of Yosemite, and you didn't say a word." And he looked surprised at me. He said, "I guess I was looking the other way." Well, that's the kind of thing that I want my books to make more difficult to do, to get people to look more closely, to not to look the other way, because I think our views of land and landscape are so crucial to our basic being and our values.
Why do you think that?
The answer is too long to keep anybody interested, but the essence of it would be this. I think that... That we, our very bodies, are made up from the elements of the earth. We are, in a sense, we're walking bits of earth. Thinking in terms of River Horse, the water book, we're more than two-thirds water. We're two-footed jugs of water going around the planet. When we pollute water, I mean, we're polluting our basic essence. And we, if I can get slightly political for a moment, we have an administration on Washington that is opposed to something as seemingly obvious as trying to get arsenic out of drinking water, to lower at least the amount of arsenic in drinking water. People in Washington saying we don't need to do that. And I just wonder, who could be opposed to getting arsenic out of drinking water? Who wants to feed arsenic-laced water to children?
See, I think the perspective, I would like to believe, which is no excuse, is rather than being opposed, they are for something else. And the something else has to do with the success of, and you make points of this, in all your books, the success of economic success, larger organizations who have political clout, and are, it's not so much they want arsenic in the drinking water as they don't want to spend the money necessary to take it out, which is, you know, the result is the same, but the perspective is a different perspective. And I think that in a way goes to your answering what Paul is asking, mm-hmm. which is, why do you do this? And the answer is, if you can't feel what's around you, you know, if your experience is solely predicated on your paycheck or your stock dividends, then you're missing, you would argue, I think, and I think a lot of people would argue, you're missing an awful lot of what's going on, and ultimately it's self-destructive.
It is, and when we talk about the economic ends, we're really talking about much shorter economic goals than the longer goal, and one has only to ask the question, well, if we leave arsenic levels higher than they could be, how much is that going to cost us over the preceding years in the health of decayed health of children or adults or whatever else it might be? I think every environmental issue comes down what economy we're looking at, the one of the moment or a much longer term one that has to do with sustainability.
I think this has something to do with William Lee Heatmoon saying, selfish and private greed that so poison one's chances for a lasting and healthy prosperity, if I may quote you. Isn't that a lot of what you're talking about? Is, are you going to be greedy now, and or are you going to be prosperous in the long term?
I couldn't have quoted myself there. And I don't know how you found that quotation so fast, but you did. But that's it in a nutshell.
Quickly. Well, and that is part of who we are and where we need to be.
There's a piece of this, in that same line, and I don't want to get bogged down in it, but...
It's all right, Bill, we'll do it when we come back.
I sat down at my computer the other day and figured out the present value of $1 million 100 years from now, which is a fairly standard economic calculation. We tend to not look out 50 or 100 years. And the answer is, it's not quite zero, but it's so small it doesn't matter. And the fact is, if we make economic decisions for our children, much less our grandchildren, nothing good can happen in terms of preserving, protecting, or enhancing the overall environment. What economics forces on us is a very short time frame, and it does not. You know, you cannot make economic decisions on the kinds of big issues you're talking about, on rivers and water and air, based purely on economic analysis.
We're going to let William Lee Heatmoon respond to that when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. Please be with us. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Our guest is William Lee Heatmoon. Bill Russell was talking about economics and was inviting you to do likewise.
Well, I just want to really concur with what he's saying and boil it to a sentence, more or less, if I can do that. And really, what you're saying, Bill, is that if something costs $10 billion today, a century from now, that figure, if we would fail to pay that price, a century from now, people are going to say, my heavens, they wouldn't even pay this fraction to ensure the health of my life in this future time.
And there's a metaphor. I mean, you talk about the finding a channel. And if you go a little bit awry, and really whether it's on the ocean or the river or on open, if you're off a little bit, bad things can happen. And you had the opportunity to find some non-channels.
Yes. And, much of the voyage went through the Louisiana Purchase, and to keep this monetary discussion going just for one more element here, people at the time, many of them were outraged that Jefferson had agreed to spend that much money to buy that territory. And we look now, I've forgotten what the figure is, 13 and a half cents an acre, whatever it was that it worked out to be. I mean, it was virtually free. We got... We doubled
except,
the size
of
this country.
Except, of course, we stole it.
So we had to deal with people who were already there and had been there for 15,000, 20,000 years. But in terms of gaining title, in terms of the eyes of Europeans, that's what we did. And to have passed that up now, you can only imagine what this country would have been like.
I want to add to your just the picture of you. You are a little bit Osage, but you are very American. I don't know many people who can go back eight generations and tell me who their grandfather was in Virginia or wherever he was.
North Carolina, actually. He was a contemporary of my grandfather.
Well, there aren't. We forget how complex this country is with all of these different strains, that you are part Osage and part lots of things. But these are mutually inclusive, not exclusive. That you, it's as important that you are speaking from your European-American roots as from your Native American roots, it seems to me, or you can't talk to me.
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes I say that that William Trogdon, my Anglo so-called Christian name, is the architect of the books, the one who does the dirty work of trying to shape these things, but the soul behind them, the ideas, that comes from the Osage, which is, as I said earlier, you know, it's a minor part of my background, but I don't think I could write without that.
And it is the name you picked, and naming is very important.
Oh, it is.
You are known to the world with that name, not the other.
Yes. Well, I had to start from my father, and people who know my work probably have heard this before, but my father in the 30s took the name Heat Moon as a way of reminding himself of that side of our ancestry, which was important to him. We did not know the Osage name of the last full blood, but we did know that he was born in July, the moon of heat. So my father in the 30s took the name Heat Moon, in addition to his Anglo name, his Christian name. When my elder brother came along and wanted to participate in this, my father sent him out on essentially a vision quest. He didn't use that phrase, but I know now that's what it was. When I came along 6 years later, I wanted in on it too. So I should say my brother became Little Heat Moon from my father Heat Moon. That left me with Least Heat Moon, or I could have chosen an entirely different name. Had I known I was going to use the name as a pen name, I think I might have picked up a different one. Believe me, particularly when your first publisher...
L-E-A-S-T.
Yes. When your first publisher is Little Brown and your first book is Blue Highways and your name is Least Heat Moon, you can imagine how that got twisted around in those early years of people going in looking for the Little Brown Moon.
It's also an honored tradition. I, as I read River Horse, I was thinking about it through good luck. I had picked up Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi. Well, Mark Twain is who we know. We don't know Samuel Clemens. Mark Twain is so important to who Americans are and how we think about who we are and where we've been. This business of a pen name that reflects a time and place. I mean, Mark Twain, maybe people have forgotten, is how you measure the Mississippi. It's a depth marker. Mm-hmm. And William Least Heat Moon, I think, will have that same kind of a resonance over time. This naming thing is important, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think it also served in my writing to remind me of certain values and certain bases that I was trying to work from. I think without that, I would have ended up writing as I did for 20 years when I sort of put the Heat Moon aside and I was trying to become a professor. For those 20 years, I was strictly William Trogdon, so I was answering to about two-thirds of my identity rather than the full thing. And I think that's one of the reasons that my writing was lousy, certainly was academic, and I think it's also one of the reasons that I felt for two decades, I felt I was a displaced person in America. When I went back to the Heat Moon, I thought, I think I just put down the other leg of the tripod. Mm-hmm. I have a kind of stability in the landscape now.
And you found your voice in that, didn't you?
I hope so.
That Native American perspective, and again, I go back to your last book, Billy Joe Conrad.
In River Horse.
In some ways, I think, is the incarnation of what you're talking about.
Tell us about Billy Joel.
Okay. His name had to be Conrad, didn't it?
In the heart of darkness.
But I'm thinking about his instinctive relationship to the river.
Another river story, very much like Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness.
Well, yeah, I hadn't thought of that connection. That's true. Part of what you're alluding to, Paula, is that on the interior of our so-called bigger boat, which was only 22 feet, we made cars in the 70s that were longer than 22 feet, but this was our big boat. Inside our little pilot house, we had two slogans. On the forward bulkhead, it said, "Proceed as the way opens." That's a phrase I took from the Quakers out of Pennsylvania. On the back bulkhead, looking at, out over the transom, was another one, Avoid Irritation, from Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And I failed to do both of those much of the time, but I knew
that's
that
an
I
ideal
should.
That you could aspire to.
Yeah. And interesting, you're making me make parallels here, but talking about Billy Joe Conrad, Bill, can we get some more Bills and Willies into this conversation somewhere?
Maybe later.
He steered us up a really dangerous, a treacherous section of the Upper Missouri River in South Dakota, primarily by sitting backwards and looking at the back of the river. And somebody said, "Is how do you do that?" And he said, "It's the same river."
Well,
for him, it's the same river. For us, it was a radically different river going upstream or down. But he knew it so well that he could do that. He could read the river backwards.
At the same time, he's telling you how to drive, as it were, up the river. And that's a lousy choice of words, verbs. He's saying, look forward. You've got to, the only way you can get up it is to look forward.
Yes.
And he is sitting more or less sober, more or less not sober, actually, looking backwards.
Yes.
And somehow or other managed to get you places that you it would have been extraordinarily difficult for you.
Well, I thought the expedition had ended on that day. I got lost in the sticks, as some people call them. They're really logs, mired logs. And
this is not to be confused with the river sticks.
No, although as I quote,
there were moments.
Yes.
Oh, indeed, yes. I quote one of our early 19th century writers calling the Missouri the river. He said, "It's not the river sticks, but it is a river of sticks." Sticks, of course, is the wrong word. These are big pieces of timber that are out there. Now, I thought this was it. We couldn't proceed any farther, and through a piece of luck, extraordinary luck, he came up and got on our boat, and up we went at a speed way too fast for my comfort. But he knew what he was doing, and we were there.
You talk time and time again about being lucky. You couldn't possibly have made this trip without being lucky. Where does that sense of just, all right, let's see what happens? Is this courage or is this foolhardiness?
I'm not sure I know the difference in the terms of river horse between those two. At times, I felt that as the leader of the little expedition, I had to be foolhardy to get us to the next stop. And at times, I think it was absolutely necessary to be that way. If we had been utterly cautious, trying to make sure that everything was going to go exactly as we wanted, I think we probably would never set off from Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Well, isn't this, again, a metaphor for life?
Well, I hope so. I like to think that proceed as the way opens is a phrase that has endured coming down to us from the Quakers, because it is so wise and so applicable to all things, with one proviso, and that is we found on the river time after time that we had to proceed to find out if the way was open, and then we were right in trouble. But I think in life that's the same way too.
Well, and it can sound like, it may have, when you first put it on the boat, it may sound like, you just wait for things to get easy and then follow the easy path. And that's not at all, certainly in your experience, not at all what happened. The opening was, may have been no larger than a pinhole, but it was an opening, and you took it consistently, and somehow or other, sometimes in spite of your best efforts, survived it.
Yes, yes.
This is the Paula Gordon Show. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Lee's Heat Moon. We hope that you'll be with us then. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are very pleased indeed that William Lee's Heat Moon is our guest. You tell me in River Horse that problem is just another way of spelling life. Well, it seems to me that all the problems that you made yourself open to or got in the way of are the whole point of all three of your wonderful books. If problem is just another way of spelling life, doesn't that invite us to places we might rather not go?
Well, I think so, but it's when we get into trouble that I think the greatest education happens for us. And a life that one lives too easily, too gently, too unprecariously, I think does not develop the possibilities that we have as human beings. I think we many times, I don't mean this every day, but at points in our lives, we need to be pushed to the brink to find out who we are, what we are, and what really matters to us. One thing that happened repeatedly on the voyage in River Horse is that when my co-pilots would leave and I would see them later, they would comment about how difficult it was to return too, maybe the word is complexity, maybe it's something else, of their contemporary lives. As one of them said, when he got back, he said, I got back, and for 2 weeks, I just couldn't deal with nitwits and pissants anymore. He said, I just had no tolerance for it. Because on the river, there was one key question that we had to face, and that is, are we gonna make it to the end of the day? Is this boat going to hold up for the next hour? Is the river going to pull us down in the next 5 minutes?
And it was life and death.
At times, it was. Our lives were very much on the line. And that just strips away some of the facades of insignificance that we place over our lives. So when I say go to the brink, that's part of what I'm talking about.
You set yourself a challenge, and then you constrained it further in ways that seemed, in some ways, to make it more difficult. You were going to do this in a year.
Well, you were going to, for reasons, and
there were additional, because you'd made that decision, a whole lot of other things had to fall in place. The locks had to be open at the right time. The river levels had to be at the right height. The snow melt had to be sufficient and melt at the right time.
Very complex.
So not only had you set out to do something that was going to be difficult anyway, then you further constrained it so that you had, I don't know another word for it, you had created a substantive challenge that you and your colleagues then launched into, and if anything, the dialogue between you and the challenge you had established creates a wonderful story with a little help from the writer.
Well, it's true. I just couldn't see writing this book attempting to cross America by boat and get halfway across and say to the reader, in effect, and there we laid over it until next year when we would come back and pick up this voyage again. I thought that is not the way you build suspense in a book. We have to put ourselves in the line. We have to do this in a year. Now, we were not the first people to cross America by boat, coast to coast, but I think we are the first one to do it in a single season and keep water under our hull almost the entire way. There were few portages, very few portages, and they were short. But that time element, as you're saying, Bill, really put constraints and pressure on us that changes the nature of this voyage and makes this book in so many ways different from especially Blue Highways. And it's, not everybody likes those differences, by the way. This is an adventure story where the real captain of this trip was time, not me. It was time.
Yeah.
And you, I can quote, Paula quoted you, and I think I can do it pretty much from memory. There's a section in there, a whole paragraph, that goes something like this. River, 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 river.
River, 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 river,
river, river. And then later in the same chapter, on, 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 on.
River, river, river.
We've been talking about adventure, but the other side of this, and this, you know, the juxtaposition, a contraposition of the journey. On the one hand, you have these striking, life-threatening circumstances, and on the other hand, just incredible, tedious boredom.
Yeah,
and that too is part of the story.
Oh, very much so. You can write around that to a certain degree, but to have ignored it entirely would be to misrepresent what it's like to go from coast to coast by water. It was important for the reader to know that there were hours, as you say, that
you don't have to quote that part.
No, but where tedium was, there's one chapter called "From Humdrummery to Tedium," I think. The thing is that the moment where we really were beginning to feel the boredom hitting us, we could just about be assured that within the next 5 minutes, something disastrous was going to strike us. So
another life lesson.
That helped. But the tedium is a key thing. I think when Lewis and Clark made their great westward trek, they expressed it in their journals as "we proceeded on," and that means there were hours of just proceeding.
You talk about Lewis and Clark. I found one of the fascinating things as you told your story was how similar it was to the great adventures of the Europeans in the 16 and 17 and 1800s, but how different it was as well, because every night, with few exceptions, virtually, well, I don't know what, you tell me, many, many nights you'd pull off and you'd go to an inn. You'd pull off and you'd find a farmhouse. That you stayed connected with the present in ways that people who were doing the first journeys into the continent, no motels available to Lewis and Clark, and that sense of isolation, but not quite removed, gave another level of tension that I found really inviting in the book.
Well, I was attempting to suggest the various modes, well, I should say the eras of traveling our rivers, so that we can have sections, long sections in the book where we're in a canoe and perhaps suggesting travel on the river before the coming of the Europeans, and we have something different from that, which might suggest Lewis and Clark and their comportment of not the comportment, but their entourage of men. But the other times, in later in the 19th century, in which travelers would move along and sometimes disembark to spend the night in a hotel, an inn, go move on the next day, so that we some nights we were in a bed and breakfast. We tried to find historic inns where we could, but there were nights where we slept aboard the boat. Not many, because it was very uncomfortable doing that. And when we were in the canoe, we would camp alongside. Those were delightful nights, but. Not as many as we wanted, partly because of high water. The floodwaters just made that difficult in places. But I'm really, what I'm saying here, in other words, Paul, is that we're attempting to move not only in space across America, we're trying to move through time across America, feeling the rivers in their eons, if I can say it that way. And I think on every body of water that we were on, at some point, we would come around a bend, and it would seem that contemporary civilization would slip away, and we were paddling in another century. Sometimes we felt this is what people 800 years ago who were on this river saw.
And yet you also saw sprawl, which you call something the effect of unbroken tedium. The sprawl of America has not stayed away from the rivers either.
No, it's less visible from the river. Which is one of the delights. We could be moving, say, along the Erie Canal, and there's a screen of trees frequently. You thought that you were in almost wilds. It's an illusion, because that's just a screen of trees. But you get to city center, and the trees fall away, and whoops, oh, here we are. We've just arrived in the middle of town. You don't go through that long purgatory of buildings, businesses, metal buildings, and franchises, and billboards. And the towns on the river have edges. They begin and they end. And as you know, on highway stay, even in small communities, that's less and less true, I'm afraid.
This is, listening to you, this is almost, this book is partly a meditation on time, not only the tedium punctuated by some moments of stark terror, whatever the line is, but it's also, there's also a vertical time that you're talking about, that, you know, these same places going back 100 years or 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years or 400 million years. You talk about, I think, your journey as the purpose of the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Fulfillment of it.
Which is a curious construct, but in a way it ties it all together. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was thinking that given that the part of the Lewis and Clark conquest is essentially it was an act of imperialism to seize this new territory. Much of what they were doing out there was to report to the primarily the Indians of the Great Plains that they now were under the dominion of the Great White Father. I mean, that's the term they used, and that they also call the Indians children of the Great White Father. These are not terms that warriors really want to hear. I think that the
they're Indians, still not popular.
No. I'm sure the Indians thought, well, these men are utterly mad, so we'll humor them. At any rate, the Lewis and Clark expedition was the first great thrust into the Louisiana Territory and onto the Pacific, which opened that territory up for later white settlement. So as we moved up the Missouri River, especially with a motor behind us, we thought this is what they would like to have done. And one of the reasons they took this land in was to open this land for people like us, for better or for worse.
This is William Lee's Heat Moon, and Bill can say what he's going to say when we come back in just a moment. Please be with us when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. We're back for a few more minutes with William Lee's Heat Moon. As you talk about the journey and the water on which you go, I think Bill will lead us to where I want to be, which is talking about the fact that these are not the same rivers that they were when Lewis and Clark were on them or when the natives were on them. Bill?
Well, you're talking about rivers, and I think, you know, when we think about rivers, you know, aside from the utility function, we tend to worry about pollution in rivers. You know, and that's certainly a significant issue, but there's another piece of this that in this country has become fairly common, which is flooding for reasons that may or may not make sense. But the things we have done to rivers in order to make them commercially, what we think of as commercially viable, and that's a big piece of the story you tell, but it's also a big piece of your experience on the rivers.
Oh, it is. Just to pick two or three here to speak of. Lewis and Clark Expedition actually began in Pittsburgh. The formal start was above St. Louis, going up the Missouri River. But the year before, they started assembling things. So they went down the Ohio. The Ohio River today, nearly 1,000 miles long, is no longer a free-flowing river. It's actually pools and dams. There are 20 dams on it that form pools. So as a result, our trip down the Ohio River, for the most part, was just a piece of cake, the easiest thing we had to do. Have to pay attention when you go through the locks, but otherwise, it's a nice sail.
Almost, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. Going up the Missouri River was easier, too, even though it was in flood in 95, because of a channelization on the lower 750 miles of it from Sioux City, Iowa, to the Mississippi, ostensibly done for navigation, to move commercial products. The problem is, on the Missouri River, there's almost no commercial navigation going on.
But we still fund that as taxpayers.
Oh, absolutely. The barge business is the most subsidized transportation industry of them all, even going well beyond what we do, the way we subsidize truckers on our highways. At any rate, our going was easier up the river because of what the Corps did. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily what we wanted. We really would rather have seen the natural river, which at that point is a braided river that is many, many different channels. And that's what Lewis and Clark faced, as every other steamboat, as the steamboats did later when they ascended the river. There's an old saying that from the 19th century among the steamboat captains, that boys go up the Mississippi, but men go up the Missouri River. There's still a certain amount of truth to that today, because the Mississippi River is probably even more changed than the upper Mississippi than the Missouri is. But nevertheless, ascending the Missouri now is an easier thing than it ever was. So we were being deprived not only of probably an abundance of wildlife that we could have seen on a naturally braided river, as opposed to one that's been turned into a conduit, a single channel conduit, but we were deprived of history.
When you say we, that's the big we, isn't it? It isn't just you guys on the boat.
Well, yeah, exactly right. I mean, we were there for the moment, but there'll be many people there behind us who will never feel this. But I think even more people traveling, taking a bridge across the Missouri River and looking down, and they see a single channel, and that's what they think the Missouri River is in its native state. That's not what it looks like at all.
There's the illusion of control, which you address in a variety of different ways, that by building these dams and doing all the things we've done and continue to do, that we somehow or other control the Missouri and that we control the Mississippi, which appears to be yet another illusion, and that's part of this vertical time, the historical time, because it's going to be there long after we're gone.
That's true, Bill. And one of my co-pilots, I think we were in North Dakota at the time, or eastern Montana, and he'd been on the upper Missouri River for some time, and he said, I just realized after all these miles, I'm not worried anymore about the Missouri River. It's so strong and so powerful, which I'd never seen before because I hadn't been this close to it. It's so strong, it's so powerful that it's going to make its way regardless. I'm worried about us. We're the ones who are endangered here. It's not the river. And indeed, we could get into the tail end of these great reservoirs that are on the Missouri River. Lake Sakakawea in North Dakota has more miles of shoreline than does California. These are massive impoundments. We could get on there and we would get to the tail end of them, even though some of them are only about 25 years old, at least at that time when we were there. They're already silting up. And we got caught twice in severe willows that were growing completely across the river. People who remember that scene from The African Queen, where Bogey and Katharine Hepburn get caught in the African Queen in the tules, and have no idea which way to go. That's what happened to us. Those reeds, they weren't reeds, they were willows. Those willows were not there 5 years ago.
You and seven of your probably dearest friends, either before or after, took this amazing river voyage from east to west, but you're the only one who did the whole thing. Did you come off that boat in the Pacific when you brought it to the water from the Atlantic a different guy than you got on?
That's a difficult question for me. I think probably somebody who saw me before and saw me afterwards could answer that. I have the feeling, though, that yes, that's true, but it took some months, probably a couple of years, before whoever got rebuilt on that river, could begin to show himself.
And he probably couldn't do it till he had written about it, could he?
Well, absolutely not. Every time I write a book, I take the trip physically, and then I go home. And for, in the case of Blue Highways, 4 years. In the case of Prairie Earth, 8 years. In the case of this, of River Horse, another 4 years to write it. And that's another journey entirely. And that's the one, it's not more important than the other, but it certainly is equally important. And that's the one that turns the well, let me say it this way, that turns a trip into a journey.
I had the sense, and maybe it's experience, that you didn't want this journey to end. You got, as you got closer and closer to the Pacific, I had the sense of you're slow, you know, almost as if you were digging in your heels because you didn't want it to end.
It was both. And one side of me wanted to get off that water so bad after 4 months, and the other side was saying, you will never have an adventure like this again in your life. And when you walk away from that river this time, 30 miles west of Astoria, Oregon, when you come off that river, one section of your life is forever over and you'll never be able to touch it again. And it was difficult. That part was difficult to accept.
It is difficult to accept that we are out of time, but we are very grateful indeed that you made the journey to be with us, William Lee Seatmoon.
It's been a delight talking with you both.
We thank Mr. Heatmoon for his willingness both to turn trips into journeys and to share those journeys with the rest of us. We'll wait eagerly for whatever comes next. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.